Hello and welcome to the Tour de France podcast with humansinvent.com. My name is Richard Moore, and tonight I'm with Lionel Burney.
Evening, Richard.
I'm with Anthony Tan Man.
Hello, Richard Moore.
And by popular request, I had an email from his mum, Matt Bowden from Velo News.
Well, hello, Richard.
Hello, Matt. Okay, folks, here we are in, where are we?
We're in Le Grand Bournonde, yep. Richard,
and
in the Alps. It's
come
raining
on,
outside.
This is where you launch into some lyrical description.
It's a lovely little town, isn't it?
Beautiful.
A small and attractive ski resort, quite unlike Alpe d'Huez, which is large, sprawling and rather unattractive.
Or concrete. This is very green, verdant.
Very green, and all the chalets look, you know, like something from the pages of Heidi.
It does look like Heidi. There was a beautiful scene at the finish before the rain started of people just sprawling on the grass watching the big screen. It was lovely, wasn't it?
And we should mention the buffet as well.
Wins
the golden knife and fork for best Tour de France press buffet.
Matt, did you enjoy the buffet? No, you missed the buffet because you were riding up Alpe d'Huez this morning.
I missed the buffet completely. I got up and I decided I'd never ridden Alpe d'Huez before, and I decided I probably wouldn't get any closer than that. We woke up on the Alp and rode down to the bottom, turned around immediately, and rode right back up. And then we drove the course, so I was a bit late today.
You're listening to the Tour de France podcast with humansinvent.com and Sharp.
Matt, as we drove off the mountain last night, it was a scene of utter devastation. How was it looking this morning?
It was grim. Well, I think it was grim for all of us. People were cleaning up Dutch Corner by the truckload. I was sort of going through my normal struggle when I climb up a mountain and try to tell myself for the 100th time that I'm just not a natural climber, and I'm not a natural climber.
More of a ruler, aren't you?
I'm more of a journalist.
Were you up with Kaylee Fretz, your technical editor? Were you riding with him?
No, it was just me. We only have one bike that we can fit in the car, so it was just me riding it this morning.
Turnabout, eh?
Yeah.
He's quite fit, isn't he?
Oh, he's quite fit.
Yeah. Other people riding as well? Was it busy?
There was lots of people. There's probably 25 cyclists on the road that I saw this morning, but I did pass them all.
Well, we're lingering on Alpe d'Huez, as it were, because there wasn't a lot to talk about in today's stage. And we'll mention our disastrous exit from the Alp last night. It's always a problem, this, whether to stay up there. I spoke to colleagues earlier who paid €400 for a box. Was that you, actually, Matt?
We did that.
You did that. You're not the only ones. And, you know, you've got this dilemma of do you pay a fortune and stay up there and have the hassle of getting off in the morning, or do you try and get off on the night? And we tried to get off last night, Lionel. We sat for 2.5 hours, I think, in traffic on the way down, and that was an evacuation.
Yeah, it was 2 hours, 26 minutes from top to bottom, actually.
Ooh, very precise.
I timed it because I thought it might be 3 hours. But, yeah, we...
So we did well.
But we did miss dinner.
We missed dinner. We drove into a McDonald's drive-through. We must have just missed it because all the staff were standing outside chatting and smoking and stuff. And they just watched us drive around this maze of tiny little roads that you have to, like an obstacle course, to get into the drive-through bit. Which negotiated all that, or Lionel did.
They make you work hard for a Big Mac in France.
Eventually we got to the end point where you make your order, theoretically, and it was closed. And Lionel then accelerated out there in a very passive-aggressive piece of driving.
It wasn't passive-aggressive.
It was just aggressive. I was trying to be kind.
It was 12 minutes past 6, and that was our last chance to get something to eat. Sorry, 6 minutes past 12.
All right.
It was 6 minutes past 12. Our last chance to get something to eat, and went to bed hungry.
I think Lionel went to bed quite grumpy, I think. There wasn't a lot of conversation in those closing few minutes.
I don't mean to rub this in, but we were able to walk right into a nice restaurant on the Alp, and I had duck. It was fantastic.
Oh, that's ridiculous. Man, what did you do?
The thing to do, though, I mean, you guys are I don't know whether I can defer to you as two of veterans, but you should know that you shouldn't go to Grenoble on the night of Alpe d'Huez.
We went to Aix-les-Bains, even worse.
Really, you should either take the back route of Alpe d'Huez, or go down. You can actually go down about a kilometre and a half and take a right, and that leads you to the base of the Glandon. So
you did that?
We went over that, the Glandon, last night at about midnight. So we didn't get to our hotel, actually, until 1 a.m., but we only had a short transfer today.
Yeah, it's problematic. Anyway, we've probably waffled enough about last night. Today's stage, we were expecting a bit more from today, I think. You know, like yesterday was a fantastic stage, and we felt that today was another very hard day. It might actually be similar to the Pyrenees, where the first day was relatively easy, but there was a lot of damage done by Sky. And the second day, though, when the other teams kind of went on the rampage, the way they rode today, does that suggest that they've given up on trying to beat Froome and they're riding for second, third?
Yeah, I think second, third, fourth, fifth. I mean, you saw at the end of the stage today there was four Saxos on the front and they were still driving the pace. But, I mean, I think that's a show of good faith at this point more than anything. I mean, there's just not much that can be done short of a crash or an absolutely fantastic bonk that seems impossible at this point.
Maybe if he misses dinner tonight.
Well, I don't think he's in any danger of missing dinner. He has people that take care of those kinds of
they
things.
They don't do McDonald's drive-thrus, do they?
But he did miss having something to eat yesterday, which cost Froome.
I think that was the point of that comment, Tamman.
Oh, were you being witty?
Well, it cost him 1,200 Swiss francs.
Oh. Was that Nicolas Portal had to pay the...
I think Portal was hit with 1,000. And I think
which is unfair, because he probably earns less than Froome.
Mm. I'm pretty sure that'll be a handshake, and that'll be taken care of, wouldn't you think?
I would hope so.
It's an expensive gel, though, isn't it?
That is an expensive gel.
You should see some of the bike shops in London.
I actually saw, our stage one today, Rui Costa, the team car came alongside him in the final 100 metres to, you know, pump his fist and celebrate. And I was watching very carefully to make sure no gel was handed over there. Not that the 20 seconds really cost him the stage, but
the bottom line about today's stage, for me anyway, was that it was the last chance saloon for any possible, you know...
What about tomorrow?
No, because this tomorrow stage is 125 kilometres long. Yes, it's got about a third of the stage is climbing, but really, today's stage, Saxo and Movistar needed to ambush Sky like they did, well, like Garmin did on the stage to Bagnaia de Bigorre. It showed it was possible. It showed that Sky was not infallible, and they needed to do it, and they didn't.
It's true. I mean, that was, we said at the time, will that be the only time in this tour that we see Chris Froome isolated? And it has been.
Well, I'm going to disagree respectfully with Mr. Tan and say that tomorrow's stage is actually quite, quite difficult.
You've ridden it?
Oh, yeah, I have ridden it. Now, all of a sudden, I'm the guy that turns into the guy who gets to ride things when he comes to the Tour de France. It's not really what happens. But that last climb is very hard, and I think that it'll do more damage, not to Froome, of course, but to everybody else. I think it'll be really, really telling of who's going to stand, and obviously who stands on the podium.
That's the thing though, Lionel, that this was the last chance for them, for even if it was an infinitesimal small chance to dislodge Froome, today was the day. That's what I'm saying. Yes, because second or fifth, there's just 47 seconds in it, so those positions can change. I'm just saying, if there was to be an offensive against Froome, it was today.
Do you think it will have to be a bit like the very short Alpe d'Huez stage, 2 years ago?
2 years.
Where the attacks came really early and really aggressive. Or do you think that it's just going to be a kind of a shootout between the GC riders for the stage win?
Oh, I think I'll give you the old two races within the race quote here and say that there's probably a break that we'll fight it out for the stage win and the GC guys will just sort of sit around and watch each other. But there's telling about 10 kilometers of flat total in tomorrow's 125K, and it's about 12,000 feet of elevation. So it's very short, but it's very stout.
Stout. I know it's the guy that's phoning you there, Matt, whose name I'll not say, just walked past me in the press centre there and said, "Hey, Roger."
Roger Moore.
Have a quiet word.
Was that intentional?
I don't know. It was just quite amusing to me.
On today's stage, though, did anyone else feel a little bit of a shame that Rui Costa won, seeing as he won a few days ago? It would have been quite nice to see somebody else.
So off in the way, though, isn't it?
It is.
When we said this about Trentin as well, you know, when he won that stage, wherever that was, where again it was a similar kind of stage where it was a break. You know, there was no pressure on him, and often when there's no pressure on somebody, they can time it right because they're relaxed and they're not worrying and overanalyzing it too much.
Well, with respect to Rui Costa, I mean, the fact is, in 1 year's time, no one's going to remember this this stage. But this is a good thing about Movistar. They went in with a three-pronged attack. It could have been Quintana, Valverde, or Rui Costa for GC. Now, with Valverde and Rui Costa having bad days, and then Rui Costa waiting for Valverde on that stage to that Cavendish one, it just left Quintana. So, I mean, that's a good thing, because BMC, for example, only had a plan A, and that was Evans. I mean, really, Van Garderen was never considered to be a leader.
Movistar, though, I mean, they've had an outstanding tour, haven't they? They really have. Of all the teams, I think they're the best team in terms of stage wins. They've got Quintana third, who might move up to second tomorrow. Really, does anybody know what Movistar are doing? I mean, I spoke to Alex Dowsett earlier in the year, and he was very impressed, as he would be. It was his new team. But just with how they were changing their approach. They're a very traditional team. They've been around forever. And they seem to have invested quite heavily in trying to give the riders the kind of support that perhaps Team Sky and Garmin Sharp and teams like that have been doing for a couple of years now. But have you spoken to Movistar at all during the tour, Matt? Tan Man?
No, I haven't spoken to... I've spoken with someone who's close to the team, and I just think, yeah, when's the last time a Tour debutant finished on the podium at the Tour de France? And
Ulrich, 96.
Jan Ulrich. Matt, I think you have to leave us now.
Yes, I'm being pulled away by my...
What are you going to do?
Well, we have a bit of a briefing, a very, very important briefing with a certain team that we're going
to
discuss
talk about it
some
or
things.
Not,
yeah, sure. I think it's the briefing that all of you have already gotten. We have a meeting with Sky and their performance director and some of their other key staff.
Tim Harrison.
Yes.
So you're going armed with some hard questions?
I won't share those
or
with you
quite yet. Or just with your ears open?
I think I'll just be armed with my normal intellect and wit and charm.
Well, maybe try and catch up with you and find out how that went.
I'm happy to come back and discuss tomorrow.
Great. Excellent. We'll enjoy it.
Bye-bye.
See you.
This is the humansinvent.com Tour de France podcast, powered by Sharp.
So that was a cheerio there to Matt. And Tanman's ears pricked up at that, because I think you had the Sky briefing the other night, didn't you? We had it back in January in Mallorca, following which they did it with the editors of the newspapers in Britain. So they've done this with a few people now. They've got a kind of set routine, and they seem to now be going around the international press.
Yeah, this is their turn, I believe, to debrief the international press, like you said. But for me, my ears pricked, because it seems that they're trying to control the conversation. You know, they're basically briefed Kerrison on what to say and what not to say, and then they're delivering, because you can't get an interview with Kerrison now unless you approach one of their press officers. It's quite hard to just get 10 minutes, 15 minutes with Kerrison, and I just think it's interesting how they're going around separately to the international media to make them feel quite, I don't know, a little bit special. But and I sort of, yeah, been invited on the bus the other night. Yeah, you go, okay, you know, they actually care about what you think and what the questions you ask. But I don't think it's like, you just can't have one hour or 2 hour sit down interview with him and go, oh, that guy's going to go away now. So
they're not, you're saying that they shouldn't think that they are, you know, in effect buying your support, or not buying it, but just getting you on side. What the briefing involves basically is that they explain how they work to a large degree. They explain how they train. We get shown a bit of data, and we got this in January. It lasted for 3 hours. It was Tim Kerrison, Dave Brailsford, and Rod Ellingworth. And it was very interesting, but I think this actually has its roots in last year's tour, where Dave Brailsford offered at one point to organise a conference where the members of the public would be invited to. That, over the winter, that never happened. I asked about that on several occasions. It didn't happen. And I think that he held this press briefing as a substitute for that, imagining that the press would disseminate the information and that would be a more practical measure than inviting the public, which I can understand the reasons for, but I don't think now that necessarily all sections of the public and certainly the people that might have come to that conference, unfortunately, they don't necessarily place all that much of a value on what journalists report back to them. Sometimes we all reported on it, what was said, and you know.
The thing is, I mean, it's interesting what you say there about Tim Kerrison perhaps being told what to say. I don't necessarily get that sense at all. I mean, Tim Kerrison is a hugely experienced sports scientist. I mean, the thoughts coming out of his mouth are his own thoughts, I would have thought. I've never spoken to him and thought he is giving us some kind of briefing in that sense. I think a lot of what they are trying to get across is actually quite complicated stuff. Okay, simple on one level, but you have to understand a lot of the theories behind it and a lot of the work that they're putting in, and you can't necessarily do that in perhaps a sort of a group Q&A session, traditional press conference thing. I mean, I spent 2011, I spent a week with the team at the Dauphiné Libéré, which Bradley Wiggins won, and I know there's the term embedded has got a sort of pejorative flavour to it. I know Richard and I would disagree a little bit on the benefits or not, but I learned a huge amount about the team and how it operated during that week, because I had freedom to go and talk to whoever I wanted and ask whatever I wanted. So I talked to the doctor on that race, Richard Freeman, about all sorts of things, policies on TUEs and treating riders and you know, training. I spoke to Tim Kerrison. I got a sort of fairly rudimentary understanding of how they gather their data, why they gather it, how much data they've gathered. I mean, for example, when he came to the team initially, he had no data on Sky, you know, so
He
had no data on cycling. So he spent the whole of 2010 just with a real watching brief. He drove around in a camper van, he collected the SRM machines.
Almost disrupted the Giro.
Yeah, he kind of learned about the sport from literally a standing start. Mm. And because of that, I think a lot of people kind of thought, who's this guy kind of hanging around in the shadows? Just from being on that Dauphiné and observing them and working around them in the sort of couple of years since, and particularly on, you know, last year's tour when they perhaps didn't get their message across at all well. I think they've got it across a lot better this year, but, you know, they still have more to do. But it isn't necessarily about, you know, we have this phrase now, asking the tough questions. It's about learning what they're doing. And I have found that they've been pretty open about what it is there attempting to do and how they're going about it. And like I say, just from that week on the Dauphiné, I didn't kind of get a sense that doors were being shut as I walked down corridors or people were being kept steered away from me.
Yeah, I welcome the openness. What I guess I have some skepticism about is you have that one meeting. When do you have the next meeting? Because after the meeting with Kerrison, I said, well, I want to now discuss with Brailsford when he intends to institute this, his idea that he broached to the press on the second rest day in Orange, which was to release all the riders by a passport, blood and power data to an expert from WADA. Now, we haven't really heard from WADA about this, and I haven't heard.
I think we have actually now.
Yeah.
They've. There was a story on Velo News today. WADA were basically saying they are not the body to do this. Now, when Brailsford mentioned it, I think he was thinking aloud, which he sometimes does, which he was last year when he mentioned this conference that didn't happen eventually.
Mm.
He is guilty sometimes of thinking aloud and coming up with ideas mid-flow, and you know, not all of those ideas materialise. WADA they've come up with some practical suggestions about what could happen. Instead, and the UK anti-doping agency is one possibility.
But can they analyse power? Because power just
don't think anybody can analyse power. That's the problem. I mean, I think that's their issue as well. That just not enough is known about. We've talked about this so much. You know, we're in danger of repeating ourselves again. But
I just don't have the wherewithal to pass on, like, to read power properly.
None of us do.
Is the thing. I had a 2-hour conversation with Kerrison. I'm not being cynical, but really he could have bamboozled me with numbers and figures and I wouldn't have known any different, even if I had a sports science degree. I am reasonably au fait.
You're very good with figures, of course.
I am. I've got quite a nice figure myself, actually.
You were telling us earlier that you deliberately tried to fail your maths tests at school.
I did, and then I end up topping the class. extraordinary.
You were just challenging stereotypes by trying to fail the maths test. Sorry, Tam, I'm sure I interrupted a more serious point.
I don't know what my point was.
You said he could have bamboozled you with figures.
Yes, yeah, and then I just think if I studied, say, sports science at university, would that help me? Yeah, might help me understand, but... I welcome the openness from Sky because it hasn't come from any other team, so that's a compliment to them. But I also want some follow-ups, and can they do this with every single member of the press? I'm wondering, you know, doing the rounds, so to speak, can they keep this open dialogue happening and on a regular basis?
Contrast, I mentioned Movistar earlier. I walked up to them the other day. Now, they've got... a translator, you know, who works quite closely with the team, and I was quite interested to speak to somebody from Movistar about, you know, the tour that they're having, and I said, sorry to bother you, but does anybody, it's my feeling that I don't speak Spanish, but does anybody on the team speak English or even a bit of French? And the answer I got was no. That was it. And that was the translator who does speak English, so not very helpful at all.
I think the difficulty is, you know, how many hundred people are there in just our bit, and we're the written press, then there's broadcast media. I mean, you can see how many demands there are on people's time while they're trying to race the Tour de France. I suppose the difficulty is that the microscope is on this race every year, and things kind of, you know, they do die down and get forgotten a little bit once everybody kind of goes away, and then we all sort of reconvene again at the big races and the subjects come up again, and it feels sometimes like we've not actually moved forward a great deal. But again, I think, you know, in terms of finding out what's going on, you have to build relationships with people, and exactly as you say, Anthony, you need to be able to follow up, listen to what one person in the team has got to say, and then go and talk to somebody else and layer your understanding over time. And
it's hard though, isn't it, Lionel, because we have these disparate groups of journalists from all over the world, and sometimes we only get together, we only converge at the Tour de France, and so it's hard to build those relationships. I mean, journalists are covering less and less races in the field, so we see these guys not as often, and therefore you have to go to things like training camps and so forth, or just call them over the phone. And now with press officers, some people say they inhibit rather than, help with, in terms of getting interviews with certain members of staff and the riders. So, yeah, I mean, just the environment is perhaps not as conducive to how it used to be when I had a Rolodex of riders' numbers and I could call them up any time of the day or night and just get a quick grab with them. I can't really do that with many riders anymore, apart from, or certainly not at the World Tour level.
It's kind of a slight segue, but I spoke to Dave Brailsford after today's stage, which was, as he said, a less stressful day for them than the Alpe d'Huez stage yesterday. Here's what I had to say. In the course of this interview, you will hear from him a dreadful Australian accent. He does an impersonation of Shane Sutton. But here's what Dave Brailsford had to say. A less stressful day than yesterday today?
Well, a totally unstressful day. There was no stress at all. The lads did a great job early on. G and Ian did a fantastic job, and that was that, really. Saxo took it on, and thanks very much.
What did you sort of think of what happened yesterday with Chris? Was there a fear that, you know, he...
No, he had underplat, that was it, you know.
Yeah.
There's no, it's not physiological, he just hadn't fed enough. And as you know, we our cooler in the back of the Jag, the bottle cooler, either that plug, you know, when you empty the thing out at the end, when you clean it, the plug came out and it flooded the boot. And that in turn fused the battery shorted and just killed the whole car. So it was our fault. We flooded our own boot. But it did mean that for like a long time they didn't get a feed. And that was the problem.
Yeah, I mean, how do you feel, you know, with a day to come, a very tough day tomorrow, obviously, before Paris?
Yeah.
Do you start to think that, you know, Chris is on the brink of winning the Tour, or is tomorrow a day that you still really fear?
Well, I think you've got to fear it. And otherwise you go in, you could end up potentially going in with the wrong mindset, you know. But I think the challenge is to really think about the stage in isolation, and as always, even though it's getting closer, as always, don't think about the outcome, you know. Don't think about the consequence of what if we win, what if we lose, and all the rest of it. Just think about the process, and the process will be how do you manage that race, you know, climb by climb, and hopefully get through me, potentially Richie, to the foot of the Seminoles with the other guys, and it's going to be a big fight. If they want to, if they want to shake the podium, if they got it, they've got to go on the offensive, but we don't. All we have to do is follow.
Yeah,
it's a bit like a point chasing. You're a lap up. Not simple, no. No, it's not. And sometimes if you do follow and you go in that kind of mindset, that can be, that can actually get you in, on the wrong footing as well. So I think you've got to be very, very alert. You've got to be aggressive. You know, and you've got to ride, I think, right, 128k.
What did you think yesterday? We've all been there as cyclists, had the hunger knock on a climb. It can be catastrophic. I mean, as you watched Chris, and it was obvious what was up with him, were there any fears at all, you know, that this, you know, that this would be a disaster, or were you confident that he could?
No, too close to the top, and I think even, you know, you could see that, you know, some of the other rivals are blown, and you know, he could have sat down, baked himself a pancake, couldn't he, with a bit of syrup on top in a tent, got back on his bike and finished. It's not been all right, really. So
how is this tour compared to last year's tour for you? I mean, you know, looking back now, last year's tour seems to have been a relatively controlled. This year has been, you've not known what's going to happen from one day to the next. It's been very unpredictable, very exciting to watch as well. How's it been to have the guy in yellow?
I think every tour that I've been involved in, but every tour has its own story, you know. And I think if you start thinking about last year and think how that's going to compare to this year, I think you start from scratch, you know, chapter one and off you go. And I think the making of the, I think Corsica was a good start. It was a hard start. You didn't have the prologue to sort out kind of a bit of the GC to start with, and I think that was quite interesting.
Stressful, yeah.
Yeah, stressful, but I think it was quite interesting. It said that there was no kind of immediate hierarchy, so I think that carried on quite a while. And then the first day, obviously in the Pyrenees, I thought, you know, wow, okay, you know, that performance was a textbook performance. But the next day, I think, set the tone for the rest of the race, really. And look, you know, it wasn't much fun at the time, but looking back, I think the aggressive nature and the way that this race has been raced has been fabulous, really. I'm sure it's been great to watch. You know, made the sport a real, you know, everybody's seen cycling at its best, really. And, you know, one day you win and one day you lose, and overall you're trying to stay in control, and you know, it's up and down in terms of a bit of a roller coaster in terms of emotion, but overall, that's what we love about a sport, isn't it? You know, if it was just a procession all the time, then.
But what about Chris? I mean, you know, you've known him for a few years now. I suppose the first question is: did you ever, in your heart of hearts, see him as a future Tour de France winner when he first flashed across your radar? And also, how has he impressed you during this tour? I mean, you've talked about his calmness, but how has he most impressed you during this tour?
No, okay, his calmness, but his mental robustness has been unbelievable. And I think not just in the face of the constant attacks, not in, you know, the that one stage. You know, we race as a team, and we very, very rarely get isolated as a team. And on the second Pyrenean stage, you know, we found himself in a very unorthodox situation for him. And I think that in itself, psychologically, he adjusted to that and he coped with that just fantastically well. And so I think the racing side, he's dealt very, very well with. But then all the off-bike stuff, you know, all the media stuff and all the questioning and all of that kind of stuff. You know, if you know that you're not cheating and you get that, and I know people say, well, we don't know, but he knows. You know, he knows and we know. And when you watch the slaughter of an innocent man, that's quite hard to take, you know, and I think he's actually done, you know, an unbelievably good job in dealing with that. So, yeah.
And what about going back to when you first came across Chris? Did you ever?
I first came across as with Shane, you know, on the beach road in Melbourne, you know, when he did that time trial, and you know, Shane's like, it's like, bloody hell, said, there's a bloke in a pair of sand shoes, he's going right really fast. There's a bloke over there, a pair of sand shoes, he's going so fast. And that was pretty much the first kind of phrase I heard about Chris Froome.
Yeah.
This is a humansinvent.com Tour de France podcast with Richard Moore and Lionel Burney.
So that was Dave Brailsford there. We heard from with, as I mentioned, I think Anthony was quite shocked by his Australian accent there. He also came out with a couple of interesting lines he mentioned about in relation to Chris Froome watching the slaughter of an innocent man, he said. And the Australian accent came in when he talked about when he and Shane Sutton first spotted Chris Froome during the Commonwealth Games in 2006, and Shane said, there's a bloke riding in sand shoes. There's a bloke riding the time trial in sand shoes. That was quite funny. Anyway, I think you wanted to sort of go back onto today's stage, Lionel. Rui Costa was the winner.
Yeah, I don't want to be disrespectful to him or any of the other riders in the break, or, you know, Pierre Rolland turned himself inside.
Clodin.
Pierre, well, Clodin was second, wasn't he? But Pierre Rolland deserves a bit of a hat tip tonight, because he rode himself into the ground to try and get the King of the Mountains jersey from Chris Froome, who is still leading that by a point. So Rolland has come up short, and he admitted afterwards he doesn't think that he's going to be close enough to the front on Semnoz tomorrow to actually win that competition. So we're faced with a situation where the King of the Mountains jersey could actually be won also by Chris Froome, almost by default. But I felt that today's stage, the way it panned out with the huge time gap that Heyerdahl and Rolland had initially, and then quite sluggish riding by the GC riders, I just got the feeling that they've got only a half a match left to burn for tomorrow's stage, and they didn't have the legs for it today. What do you think, Anthony?
Just on the mountains classification, I just feel that year after year, this classification is it's almost like the bastard child of the Tour de France classifications. It's won by really only the rider who actually cares for winning it, and if Roland does not win it, then it's won by Froome, who was asked today whether he
knew he had it.
He didn't even know.
Well, he goes onto the podium to be presented with the jersey, doesn't he? So he will. I think he realised.
He knew by then, but I don't think he knew perhaps before, like 5 minutes before someone told him. So, yeah, you look at the guys who have won it before. I mean, I just like it to be won by
the best climber.
The best climber. For example, the previous years we've had Chateau, we've had last year we had
Moncoutier, maybe not on the tour,
Volkler.
But he's
I don't know. I just feel there's not a lot of kudos attached to it, for example, like the points.
I remember there used to be. There used to be,
and people used to target it properly. And without wanting to plug something that I've written for a popular weekly cycling magazine's website, I've kind of explored this a little bit. And I think yesterday at Alpe d'Huez, it was quite interesting that the organisers released a classification of the riders' times for the second ascent of Alpe d'Huez, and Quintana was the quickest up there by 3 seconds from Rodriguez. And I just think the technology exists now to have a radical revamp of the King of the Mountains competition, where you pick one climb on each stage, whether that's a sort of flattish stage and only a sort of fourth category type climb. And in the mountains, you pick in the case of yesterday, the final climb of Alpe d'Huez. Perhaps today you would pick the first climb of the day, the big all category one, and you award points based on time. So whether you're in a break or whether you're in the bunch, your time on that climb is what scores you points. And I think, you know, with the advent of Strava, the whole world is now broken up into segments, isn't it? And it would perhaps Prudhomme has changed the points competition quite significantly with the introduction of the bumper intermediate sprint. Hasn't really had a great deal of effect because of Sagan's complete dominance. But the King of the Mountains competition needs
a revamp. The cycling technology is, for such a technological sport, it's not particularly innovative when it comes to new ways of, as you say, of scoring that competition or broadcasting as well. You know, where the cameras on bikes or in team cars, it's been experimented with in the past. There must be new ways of broadcasting the sport, and as you say, Lionel, of judging it.
Reinvigorating the competition and making the race different. I mean, then you would have something where climbing times became a relevant part of the conversation. Then you could actually open up that debate into, wind conditions and weather, and whether riders are being paced. You could radically alter how some of the climbs are ridden in the Tour, whether it's the smaller ones or the giant mountains, and just give this competition something. Because this morning Riblon had, I think, 77 points, 74 of which he scored on yesterday's stage. Does that make him the King of the Mountains? He's already won a stage in fantastic style, but it doesn't make him the true King of the Mountains.
I mean, this, King of the Mountains competition, I was, taken to task a little bit by our good friend Daniel Freeb today for mentioning that Chris Froome would be only the second English-speaking winner of the King of the Mountains title after Robert Miller in 1984. He kind of took issue a little bit with my distinction of English-speaking. What I should have written was British. I mean, he would be the second British winner of that.
Who's the other English speakers to have won the King of the
Nobody,
Women?
That's what I mean.
Right.
That's what I mean. He just objected to this being a category, English speaking. But I think that harks back to the 80s when some of us got involved in watching cycling, and the English-speaking designation actually meant something then, because there were so few of them. And the English-speaking crew, you know, we called them the Foreign Legion, didn't we? They were known as, our colleague Rupert Guinness wrote a book, The Foreign Legion, about the English speakers who, you know, came from Australia, the US, Great Britain, Ireland. Far more so in those days, it was certainly a designation that was worth recognising, I think. Daniel's not old enough to realise that, so...
No, he's just a baby. Also, I just want to get back to Lionel's first point about the stage. Why wasn't Sky ambushed? I think it's a question worth asking, and I think it's because this has been one of the hardest final weeks of the Tour de France I can remember in 15 or 20 years, where you have the final time trial quite early on, and then you have three consecutive mountain stages. I mean, I added up all the climbs in these 3 days, and it's almost totals 150 kilometres of climbing. I mean, it's I don't know whether you can say it's insane, but it's, you know, it's a hell of a lot, and each of those stages, you know, it's roughly a third of the stage was uphill. So, and you look at what they've done before. I mean, right from the get-go in Corsica, the race was very, very difficult.
Brailsford mentioned that in the interview. You know that he, you know, we obviously all heard that, but he talked about how stressful it had been from day one without the prologue. The race was really on. Those 3 days in Corsica were tricky.
Yeah, it's not like, I don't think it's Movistar and Saxo Tinkoff didn't want to attack. It's just that they couldn't. And you've got the guy Quintana, all of 23 years old, riding his first Tour de France. And what do we actually expect? I guess I wanted him to really go
rip it up.
I just wanted him, like, to
Chiappucci in 92.
Yeah, throw caution not just out the window, but, you know, flush it down the toilet. And he didn't do that, but I understand that you want to preserve that.
Why would
that
you do
place.
That? And you look at Laurens ten Dam, you know, a guy who a couple of days ago was in contention for the podium, and you can see he's just exhausted, and Mollema as well. Guys are running out of steam, aren't they?
Yeah. they rode. I mean, Belkin, you know, they rode conservatively, and I think it cost them. I look at what Quintana has done in this tour. You have to give him credit, because he really has, you know, he's really thrown his kitchen sink at them, and I think he's thrown pretty much everything. I don't really think he's got much. Maybe it was a good idea anyway to save what he has got for tomorrow, because he's only 20 seconds behind Contador.
That's a hard climb, a hard, hard climb.
And it suits a climber as exquisite as
if he can steal Froome's energy gels in the course of the stage and isolate him from his teammates, then he's got a real chance. Eh?
Hey, that's interesting. I just want to ask you about that feed yesterday, which, well, was given by Richie Porte to Froome, so they both got docked 20 seconds. I mean, can an energy gel work so fast?
Yeah, I think it can. I think it can. I think, you know, when you get the knock, you, especially with something sugary, you feel the benefits almost immediately.
Okay.
I think we had this conversation last night, didn't we, Lionel? In the cars, we were waiting to, in between watching episodes of The Trip on your iPhone.
While we were sat in a traffic jam
we weren't driving, obviously. Right. But we discussed the whole nature of this, you know, ban on being fed by the car. It reminds me a little bit of the time when riders were only allowed two bidons in the course of a stage. There's something odd about denying riders food if they need food. I mean, are the demands of the tour not enough that's really takes it into the inhuman side? I know that's maybe an exaggerated thing to say and over the top, but, you know, he was only 5 kilometres from the summit. But it does seem an odd rule. We understand the reasons for it, especially on a climb, but still, it does seem like a strange rule.
Yeah.
I mean, we saw, just sorry, Tam, to interrupt, but we saw today, you mentioned Pierre Roland earlier, he was getting quite a few sticky bottles on the climb where he was away, and you could see the difference that made to his speed. A sticky bottle being a bottle that you get from the car, but take an awful long time to actually... it takes a long time for it to be released by the person in the car
while the car accelerates. Sort of accelerating a bit. Yeah, it's a sort of slingshot.
It's a slingshot, yeah.
I think the thing is about the, you know, we all know from riding bikes, you know, obviously not at that level, but we all know that horrible feeling of being completely empty.
Speak for yourself, Lionel. Ricky and I have ridden at quite a high level.
Oh, you two have ridden at a very high level. I haven't. But I certainly know that feeling of just that sort of almost sick feeling in the stomach when you're completely empty, and a gel can just take the edge off that and just give you enough just to keep going.
Sorry to interrupt. Did you have anything else to add on that? I'm just conscious of time ticking.
Just want to throw it out there. It'll be interesting to do a blind test to see if that energy gel contained nothing really, and then one which was high in sugar, just actually
consuming something. Lionel, can you introduce your interview that you did, please?
Oh, yes, I can. Yesterday I spoke with Rob Hales, who must be one of the hardest working members of the media working on the tour, present company excepted. He is working for British Eurosport, doing interviews at the start and the finish, and in between that he's commentating for BBC Radio 5 Live. So he's kind of working for two bosses. He's got two lots of responsibility, and when he's not working on the Tour de France, he's kind of part of Cavendish's coaching team. So I spoke to him about how his tour is going, and we looked ahead a little bit to Sunday in the Champs-Élysées and asked whether Mark Cavendish can make it five in a row. I'm with Rob Hales, who must qualify as one of the hardest working men in the media on this Tour de France, because you've got two high profile gigs. You're filming interviews for Eurosport and you're on BBC 5 Live Extra as well. How have you been finding it?
It's been good, actually. After just doing commentary at the Giro, with the logistics involved with that, I came back and I was starting to panic about the tour, because, yeah, I'm doing most stage starts for Eurosport, trying to get interviews, little pieces to camera, just to try and set up the studio stuff back home for the day. And then we're dashing to the finish, and I'm doing the last hour and a half with Simon on 5 Live. And then, literally, as soon as I cross the line, we'll finish the commentary, and then I'm having to run down and find Daryl, my cameraman, who's lurking around the buses and trying to get what interviews we can ready for the following day to go out in the studio again. So yeah, it's pretty hectic. We've covered around 5,000 k's in the car between the two of us, but I'm coping really well, actually. I'm enjoying it, and having been working for Eurosport as well, I've got my little accreditation here with a little barcode on it, which means I can go down to France Television Canteen. So, which is, it's not bad at all. So it's three course lunches most days, and you know, it's all right. So you, like the riders, I've got to keep on top of my fueling, and much to some people's misconception, I've not been on the Haribo all tour.
You should pop into the press room one day and sample the buffet we get.
I've seen it. Well, I turn up to commentary and Simon and the lads are there, and they've got their little brown bags. And well, he opened one up today. But it was a baguette with a little bit of ham in and half a gherkin. So I then I'll see you in an hour, and I trotted off, and I've just come back from lunch now.
One of your other gigs, of course, is working with Mark Cavendish. You often are on the scooter, motor pacing him in training, work pretty closely with making sure he's ready. What's your relationship like with him in the race? Because it's a completely different one, trying to get interviews with him. Do you get any special access?
I think that's one of the things that a lot of people presume, that I can just go, oh, go on, let me on the bus, it's me, but it doesn't work like that. And if anything, I'm a little bit more standoffish than a lot of the other guys who are trying to get interviews, because of the relationship that we have, and I don't want to overstep the mark. But generally, we don't speak that much. The odd text, we get the odd phone call to each other, but his time is very precious during the tour. And rest days, I went and did an interview with him, a 10-minute interview on the last rest day a few days ago. But Peter was there, and Delilah, and, you know, so he's spending time with the family. So it's not overstepping the mark. And it's very, very strange as well, being so close with him, being best friends, and then having to sit down in a formal situation whereby we're mic'd up, there's a cameraman there, and I'm then having to kind of interview. And the things that I've been doing this tour, they're less about being an interview or trying to take the formal side of it out, and they're more of a chat. So, which seems to be working quite well. At least I think it is. Anyway, it's more kind of interjection and more of a conversation rather than three or four questions and trying to get an answer. I'm trying to get a little bit of a different angle on it from how most of the interviewers would be getting from the riders and with Dave Rowles, with people like that.
How is Mark bearing up? Because it's been a tough tour for him.
The sprints
have been really competitive. Sagan's pretty much untouchable in the green jersey, but there's still that carrot of winning yet again on the Champs-Élysées on Sunday.
There is. I mean, he's had a tough year. He started in Qatar, and then the Giro was tougher on most of the riders than I think they were expecting, what with the weather and the course. And so coming into the tour, he was fit, he was going well, he was obviously going well, because he wouldn't have been able to have won the national road race in the style that he did if he didn't have the form. But his sprinting, top-end sprinting, was just lacking a little bit, I think. And coming into it, I think it was fairly inevitable that if Sagan rode anything like he did last year, the green was going to be his. So Kev was just looking for stage wins. Obviously, a massive disappointment on the first day for him, and Greipel not being able to get up there. And Kittel obviously taking the stage. But not only that, the yellow jersey. And that's something that... Well, it's been the first opportunity for the sprinters to have that for years now. So big disappointment, and I think he's just been frustrated. He had a crash on another one where he was third. But having said that, the second stage he did win, stage 13, I think should definitely go down in history as one of the best one-day bike races ever. It was absolutely fantastic the way that his team orchestrated that, and then obviously it was taken up by Contador and Team Saxo Tinkoff for the GC. It was one of the most incredible stages, and I said to him, of all the stages to win from a small group sprint, that was the one to have. So I think it's been overall quite frustrating for him, but then he's used to winning four or five stages in the tour, and unfortunately he's human. It's a bike racing, and you can't do that all the time. He won the red jersey for the sprinter's jersey for the Giro earlier, and that was something that he's never done before. So overall, his season's been absolutely fantastic. But yeah, here at the Tour, here and now, he's a little bit frustrated, but he's got to get through the next couple of days. Today's obviously a tough one without Duez twice, and then tomorrow's stage is difficult. But if he can get himself to Paris, then he's got one more bite of the cherry, and he's hoping to go for his fifth in a row stage win on the Champs-Élysées.
Now, you rode for the Cofidis team for 3 years, although you didn't ride the Tour
fortunately
for them. but we collaborated on your very fine book, if I can declare an interest there, Easy Rider. And one of the aspects of the book that I found most interesting was your recollections of riding for Cofidis and how the perception was that you were joining one of the best cycling teams in the world, but actually the reality was that they were quite a long way behind in terms of the sort of technical advancements that you had experienced at British Cycling. Looking at a team like Cofidis in this tour and comparing them to the likes of Omega Pharma, Sky, Garmin, can you still see they've got a lot of ground to make up, or do you think they are gaining ground in terms of approaching the racing more as a team and a technical unit?
I would say that in many respects they're still light years away. We see a lot of these teams.
We're having banana thrown at us by Sean Kelly.
Do you know what? Because Sean's here commentating for Eurosport, so I've been travelling around with him quite a lot. And well, we daren't park a car anywhere near each other because it's. Well, they got married this week by the looks of it. They had just married on the back of the car and white ribbons all over it. They looked a right pretty couple driving off into the sunset. So it doesn't surprise me that he's trying to abuse us here and now. But yeah, back to the bike race.
The Cofidis.
Yeah, they, in many respects, they're light years away with with things that they do. I think the problem is they see from the outside, they get a glimpse of what teams like Sky do and the British team, you know, before it. For instance, the warming up, the warm down. So they've started doing that now. Something that they would have laughed at me if I'd have done that back in, you know, back 10 years ago. Got the rollers out after a stage, the turbo trainer after a stage to warm down. But now they're doing it. But it's when they do it and how they do it. They just see it and go, oh, that's what we need to do. That's what they do, so we need to do it. And they don't really kind of go really in depth and understand fully the process of what's being done.
The Tour de France with humansinvent.com. Innovation, craftsmanship and design.
So that was Rob Hales there. So our last little segment of our humansinvent.com Tour de France podcast. We've lost Matt Bowden, but still got Tan Man. That's, and
well,
Lionel Burney.
Who cares if you're lost? You know,
yeah, he's gone. He's gone. We're going to get him back, though. So, final part. Let's have the bit that we've all been waiting for.
And now, Pedaleur de Charme.
Thank you, Chiro. Introducing, as ever, our Pedaleur de Charme. Lionel's got his hand up.
Yep, Ryder Hazardal for those glasses. Those glasses that he's wearing. Pedaleur sans charme. Yeah. If you've seen the remake of Charlie and the Chocolate Factory with Willy Wonka played by...
Oh, yeah, Johnny Depp.
He wears a pair, just Google Johnny Depp, Willy Wonka, and see the white rimmed glasses.
Be careful with that.
The white rimmed glasses he wears, I think in the scene with Mike TV, I'm not sure. They're real kind of. They're
a
pretty
Johnny,
out there.
A Johnny and a Willy in the same search.
But Ryder Hazardal is wearing a very similar pair of glasses today, and I can't work out whether they look great or awful.
I've worked that out. Okay, my Pedaleur de Charme, controversial one here, Andreas Klöden. Still a super stylist after all these years. He's always looked great on a bike. I'm not sure if he really enjoys riding a bike, to be honest. He's at what age is he now? 37, something like that?
Yeah, I mean...
You know, Andreas Klöden represents a different time in cycling. He's a kind of villain, almost, in a way. He's the guy... And, you know, Daniel Monjean was announcing him as he came towards the finish in second as having finished second in the 2004 Tour. And you think, well, hang on. If Lance Armstrong's been stripped, why is Andreas Klöden not jumping up and down saying, I want that title? That tells us a lot. However, he does still look good on a bike. But Klöden, yeah, he's just... His presence, although I've brought him up and I've kind of given him this award, his presence is something about it is slightly unpalatable, isn't it? The other thing about Klöden is, what would have been fascinating was if he had won the stage. He doesn't speak to journalists. He hasn't spoken to journalists for years, least of all German journalists, because he'd fallen out big time with them. But he didn't speak to any journalists. I mean, Daniel Freeb did a very excellent profile on him for Pro Cycling Magazine, I think last year, where he spoke to a lot of people about Klöden. And he's become this kind of enigma as a consequence of his refusal to speak to journalists. Had he won the stage, he would have been wheeled out in front of us, and that would have been worth it, I think.
Yeah, but I mean, perhaps he should have a different title. I mean, that peddler perhaps has a different meaning. Peddler.
Different spelling.
Peddler.
I'm not sure if this will get us in trouble.
Are the lawyers listening?
We hope not.
Peddler of lies.
Anyway, that's fine then. Okay. Yeah, I mean, Andreas Klöden... He has paid, he did make a payment, didn't he, in order to avoid facing the consequences of some doping charges a couple of years ago.
Yeah, he did.
Has
he ever
on record.
Admitted any sort of involvement?
I don't believe he has, no.
From these Team Mobile days?
No.
You get the feeling he rides for the salary and the...
Somebody said that. You know, it's funny, you think, how does a guy like that even motivate himself to get in the break and, you know, and finish second on the stage? Because what came through in Daniel's piece very much was that he was somebody who was, you know, doing it for as long as possible, for as much money as possible, and then he will retire.
It's a hard sport to have that attitude towards, I would have thought.
Yeah.
But how is that different from a lot of people who do jobs which they don't necessarily like doing, but they just do them because it provides them an income?
With a very good income,
but,
in this case.
Yeah, so, I mean, yeah, but still, as Lionel said, very hard sport to... ride it, like just, that. And this this stoic expression he's got on his face, even when he is in the break, I mean, he imbues you with nothing other than, well, just, I don't know, you just don't really feel like watching him.
No, okay, so maybe an inappropriate nomination by me well, this evening.
Well, he's Pedler de Charme or Pedler sans Charme.
Pedler sans Charme, but he does still look quite classy on a bike. Yeah. But it's interesting, isn't it? What you mentioned there, Anthony. We're gonna wrap this up soon, but I suspect that he's not the only one professional sportsman who has lost the love of the sport, and there is this disconnect that I think I mentioned once before between what the fans expect and what the reality is for some sports people. As you say, for some people, it is just a job. I mean,
I need to. You've just jolted my memory, Richard, because someone who had that mentality was actually Bradley Wiggins. I interviewed him about maybe before the. When he was still riding with T-Mobile anyway, before it went to High Road, and he said, "Look, mate," he goes, "I don't really care about the road, I'm just doing it." He actually told me he's just doing it for the money.
Mm.
And that made me think, well, geez, is this what it's come down to? I mean, can you honestly...
That probably explains a lot, I think. Mm. David Miller, I think, was the same before his suspension. I remember going to interview him and... in his early years, he was very colourful and interesting on books he was reading, music he was listening to. I remember going to interview him in 2003, and he said, I said, what books are you reading? I don't read books anymore. What music are you listening to? I don't listen to music anymore. I basically have no life outside cycling. This is going to be my life for the next 10 years, and I've just got to be professional about it, he said. And being professional was synonymous with not really enjoying it. Mm-hmm. I mean, just on another... it reminds me as well of a friend of mine who came to the tour a couple of years ago, and he arrived in the final week when everybody is a lot of people anyway are kind of looking forward to going home on teams and so on, and he was working in a team. I'll not say what he was doing, but he was working within a team, and he came and joined that team for the final week, and it was his first experience of the tour, and I think he expected everybody to be just full of the joie de vivre of being involved in this great circus, being inside the bubble. And what he found was just completely disillusioned and fed-up mechanics and soigneurs who were desperate to go home. And poor guy, it was very disillusioning for him. But that is the reality for a lot of people who work on the tour.
Without getting caught into the trap of declaring cycling completely clean now, where it wasn't in a number of years ago, I do think there is a different feel about the end of this race compared to perhaps previous editions I've done, 06 and 07, there was just a haunted, the doping scandals had just got so deep, and everybody was just avoiding any contact with anybody. They didn't want to talk about anything. They just were trying to get to Paris and get the hell out of here because the tour had been dragged through, so many scandals. Here, I just get this feeling that everybody is absolutely exhausted, and that's, it does kind of come across when you see the riders, They are getting extremely weary now.
But we're not exhausted. We're still absolutely full of joie de vivre. You were a little bit exhausted, a little bit grumpy last night, Lionel.
I'd missed dinner.
Yeah, I know. It's I'd missed dinner as well, Lionel. but anyway, I had a lot of fig rolls in the car, and that kept me going.
Oh, I like those figaloo.
they're good. Yeah, we like them. Thank you very much, Lionel.
Thank you, Richard.
Thank you, Anthony.
No problems. It was a pleasure. This is my third time. I'm obviously quite
checks
popular.
In the post.
Thank you.
And we'll be back tomorrow night with another fun-packed podcast.
Yeah, that will be our penultimate one, won't it?
It will. It will. The end is drawing near.
Are we exposed? This is what every security team is wondering. But with vulnerabilities scattered across network, cloud, AI, and OT silos, the truth is out of reach, and attackers know it. There's a better way. Unify to defy risk with Tenable AI-powered exposure management. Tenable brings together all your security data and exposures in one unified view, giving you the attacker's map and revealing the critical paths and weaknesses they can exploit. Now your teams can prioritize intelligently, move decisively, and collaborate without friction. Tenable turns scattered work into a single proactive force. Instead of chasing noise, your team knows where to focus, gaining clarity, control, and speed to reduce cyber risk with confidence. Learn more at tenable.com. Tenable, your exposure ends here.
Here for the Lowe's early Black Friday deals? You're right on time for some of our biggest savings. We're talking up to 50% off select major appliances, plus up to an extra 25% off when you bundle select major appliances. Holiday lights going up soon? Select ladders are up to 50% off right now. Get Black Friday prices without the Black Friday crowds. Lowe's, we help you save. Valid through 11/19. Selection varies by location. Select locations only. While supplies last. See Lowe's.com for more details.
If you love to travel, Capital One has a rewards credit card that's perfect for you. With the Capital One Venture X card, you earn unlimited double miles on everything you buy. Plus, you get premium benefits at a collection of luxury hotels when you book on Capital One Travel. And with Venture X, you get access to over 1,000 airport lounges worldwide. Open up a world of travel possibilities with the Capital One Venture X card. What's in your wallet?
Terms apply. Lounge access is subject to change. See CapitalOne.com for details.